We are in Mark chapter 10 today, and we'll be finishing up chapter 10. Our passage is verses 32 through 52, Mark 10, 32 through 52. And Megan's going to read in just a minute. Here's where we are in our passage today. Jesus is getting very close to Jerusalem. Over the past couple of chapters, we have burnt through about a year over the past several weeks. And in a year of Jesus' time, as not every event is recorded. And he today is on his last leg, this final, it's about a 15-mile journey that he is going to be walking today into next week as far as our study is concerned in Mark. Next week, we will see the triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And then over a couple of weeks, we'll see his Passion Week experience in the temple. And then we'll be looking at the Last Supper and very quickly coming to the crucifixion and resurrection over the course of the next about eight sessions that we have left, 8 or 9 weeks that we have left in this. So we'll be going through, like in 2019, we'll be going through Easter and stuff before it happens in Mark. But that's okay, because we're drilling down on this, because this is some important stuff that we're working on. And so there is one last major lesson that the disciples have to hear, have to learn, before Jesus gets to Jerusalem. And that's going to be in our passage today, Mark 10, 32 through 52. And so I'm going to ask Megan if she would read for us, and then we'll come back and make our comments along the way.
They were on their way, going up to Jerusalem. Jesus was going ahead of them, and they were amazed. But those who followed were afraid. He took the 12 aside again and began to tell them what was going to happen to him. "Look, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be handed over to the chief priests and experts in the law. They will condemn him to death and will turn him over to the Gentiles. They will mock him, spit on him, flog him severely, and kill him. Yet after 3 days he will rise again." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him and said, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." He said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" They said to him, "Permit one of us to sit at your right hand and the other to sit at your left in your glory." But Jesus said to them, "You don't know what you are asking. Are you able to drink the cup I drink or be baptized in the baptism I experience?" They said to him, "We are able." Then Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink, and you will be baptized in the baptism I experience. But to sit on my right or at my left is not mine to give. It is for those to whom it has been prepared." Now, when the other 10 heard this, they became angry with James and John. Jesus called them and said to them, "You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those in high positions use their authority over them. But it is not this way among you. Instead, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be the slaves of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life for a ransom for many." They came to Jericho. As Jesus and his disciples and a large crowd were leaving Jericho, Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, a blind beggar, was sitting by the road. When he heard that it was Jesus the Nazarene, he began to shout, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Many scolded him to get him to be quiet, but he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called the blind man and he came to him. "Have courage, get up. He is calling you." He threw off his cloak, jumped up, and came to Jesus. Then Jesus said to him, "What do you want me to do for you?" The blind man replied, "Rabbi, let me see again." Jesus said to him, "Go, your faith has healed you." Immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the road.
All right. Thank you, Megan. So there are two separate stories going on here, right? Verses 32 down through 45 and then 46 to 52. And there are going to be some parallels that we're seeing along the way. And maybe you saw some of those already just as Megan was reading, as you were listening. So back up in verse 32, Mark 10, verse 32, they were on their way to Jerusalem. Jesus was ahead, and some of them were amazed, and they were also a little afraid, because Jesus keeps talking about not what they expect, right? Jesus is talking about death. He's talking about in the future. He's not really talking about setting up the kingdom that they expected him to set up the kingdom. In fact, just in the previous verses that Philip tackled a couple of weeks ago for us, he just said, if you give up, remember the story of the rich young ruler, and Jesus said, you have to this man, you have to give up all of your wealth and come follow me. Because the wealth was holding him back. He loved his wealth more than he loved Jesus. That's not a command to everybody, but for this man it was. And Peter piped up and said, hey, we left everything behind. What do we get out of this? Right? And Jesus said, anybody who does that, anybody who forsakes this life in order to follow me, will not only gain reward in the next life, but will also gain reward in this life. And the fact that he said we'll gain wives and houses and children and friends and everything, I think we have to understand that as part of a larger family, right? That's part of the idea of the family of God, the body of Christ, is that we have a whole new set of relationships, even if that means that we have to lose relationships in our old life, right? The church is supposed to be a family. It's supposed to have a relationship level that we may not have with our families. And so the truth that we're coming right out of this, the truth that is still at the front of Jesus' mind is that of embracing humility, right? Embracing dependence. Greatness comes from humility. And we're going to see this again, and they still don't get it, and Jesus is going to have to keep coming back to this. And so they're amazed, they're in awe, but they're also a little afraid. And so as they went along the way, he took the 12 aside, like he's been doing. He's been trying to stay away from the crowds, but there are people coming in from all over the place, literally all over the world at this point, to come to Jerusalem for Passover. It's one of three feasts, one of three celebrations that, not Purim, not like they're celebrating this week, but Passover is one of the big three that God did give to Israel. You must celebrate this. You must remember this. And the men, the Jewish males, were required to come to Jerusalem to sacrifice at the temple. And so at this time of year, in the spring, we'll be celebrating Passover. Actually, this year, Passover is Easter weekend. Doesn't happen very often at all, but Passover in 2019 is Easter weekend. So that's a really cool thing, because that's when the resurrection happened, was it Passover. So very cool that it's happening that way this year. Doesn't happen that way very often at all. And so in the spring, they're coming together. They're converging on Jerusalem. And so there are a lot of people that have never seen or heard Jesus before, or maybe they heard about him last year when they were in Jerusalem. But the population of Jerusalem exploded during this time of year. And so there's a lot of people around that they don't know who this guy is. Isaiah 53 tells us that there was nothing special about him as far as his looks or anything. So he just looked like one of the guys traveling down the road. And so it's not like this crowd, most of them were following him, listening to every word. Some of them were. So he took the 12 aside and he said, I've still got some things that I need to talk to you about. And he said, listen to the detail. The detail that he shares with them is just amazing. This is the third time now recorded that he is going to tell them what is about to happen. He took the 12 aside, verse 32, and began to tell them, this was an ongoing thing, what was going to happen to him. And listen to the detail, verse 33 and 34. They're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be handed over. The word also means to be betrayed. It can go either way, depending on the translation, be handed over or betrayed. To the chief priests and the experts in the law, or maybe your translation says the scribes, they're going to condemn him to death. Turn him over, same word, betray or hand over to the Gentiles, mock him, spit on him, flog him severely, and then kill him. And in 3 days, he's going to rise again. Isn't that detail amazing? A week out, this is the most detail he's ever shared with them. It includes now something about the Gentiles, which he hadn't said before. It includes the mocking and the spitting and everything that he hadn't said before. And there are some people who say, well, Jesus didn't know what he was getting into, which why he, when he was in the garden, that's why he's like, oh, no, I think this is going to be worse than I thought. If I read this, I think he's pretty clear on what he's getting into, don't you? And the fact that he voluntarily, intentionally, willfully walked into this, not kicking and screaming, he wasn't dragged into this. Yes, when he was in the garden, he's like, if there's any other way, because, you know, God may have had a plan he didn't share with Jesus at that time because Jesus had set aside the voluntary use of his divine attributes. So when he said things like, I don't know that, at that time it was true. He didn't know. He set that aside so he could live as a human, just like us, experience everything we do. So is it possible that God has something that he didn't tell Jesus? Not really, but Jesus, in his emotion, in his humanity in the garden, that we'll see in a couple of weeks, if there is any other way. If you've got something you've been holding out on me, now's the time, right? Because he knew exactly what was going on. He knew exactly what he was walking into, and he needed them to know. They didn't understand it. I think they just didn't take it literally. I think they thought that maybe there was some kind of symbolism going on here. It's going to be horrible as you set up your kingdom. Okay, guys, I'm not setting up the kingdom yet. There's going to be death and resurrection. Well, yeah, but when the kingdom comes, no. I was talking with a guy on Facebook this week who his theology was just bad. I almost called him Patrick. It was just bad. And it was a civil conversation. We're chatting back and forth, but the whole and he took one of my comments and he posted a whole new thread so his friends could, you know, gang up on me too. And so we're talking back and forth, and what it comes down to, their interpretation and my interpretation of the Bible are so different because they see this is full of symbolism and you can't take it literally. Well, that's not what it means, you know. But yeah, it says that Messiah is going to sit on the throne in Jerusalem. But what it really means is that Jesus is going to be in heaven and the church is going to be on earth. I'm like, how and when did Messiah on the throne in Jerusalem just change to Jesus in heaven and the church on earth? And you mean that that's the same thing? How do you even get to that point? Well, you can't take it literally. That's the throne. Jesus doesn't have to sit there for 1,000 years. That's just symbolic. Like, well, I assume that what he wrote is what he meant, and that's how I interpret it. And so here, the disciples are doing the same thing. This is not a new phenomenon. I'm going to be going through all of this stuff. Wow, it must be a hard time setting up a kingdom. Stop it! You know, don't you think you want to just wring their necks sometimes? Probably wants to do the same thing with you and me sometimes, yeah? Another thing I think is really interesting in here is you notice in verses 33 and 34 that he does everything in the third person. They're going to mock him and kill him and spit on him and flog him and everything. Who's the him? Go back one verse for us. Go back to 33 for us. Who is the him? The Son of Man. Who is the Son of Man? Okay, Jesus, but bigger. What does the Son of Man mean? What is the Son of Man? The Messiah, right? The coming Messiah, the coming King, the one who is supposed to do all this, comes out of Daniel chapter 7, where the Son of Man is standing before the Ancient of Days, and the kingdom was given to him, where he was going to rule all the nations and the world, and everybody was going to bow down and worship him. And so they've got this messianic idea. It's just like the rest of Israel at that time, that Messiah is going to swoop in and change everything and fix everything, and it's going to be wonderful because that's what the prophets said was going to happen. What the prophets didn't see is that there had to be a death first. And it didn't matter how many times Jesus said this will happen, they still couldn't get out of the Son of Man mode. They couldn't get out of the Messiah, the King mode in their minds. And so Jesus said, yes, I am the Son of Man. Yes, I am the Messiah. Yes, all of those things that were prophesied will indeed happen. We're not throwing that away. But the Son of Man also has to go through this first. And when you see these things happen, what should have taken place is that their faith was strengthened. Because if Jesus can prophesy all of this stuff, and it's going to happen about a week later, then shouldn't that strengthen their faith in the prophecies that were made 600, 500, 700 years ago? Yes, it's the same guy. It's the same one. And so, James and John had a question. And they came up, and in Matthew, they came up behind their mother. Their mother actually asked the question. Matthew puts that piece in there. Mark doesn't do that. But Matthew puts the piece in that they came up behind their mother, and their mother asked the question. But Mark says James and John had a question. And you would think that after this conversation about, you know, the death and everything, that this is going to be a very important, solid question, right? Maybe they're going to get this. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came up and said, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. We want you to give us a blank check and go ahead and sign it so that we can fill it in with whatever we ask." And he said, "What? What is it that you want that I should do for you?" Now, did he know what they were going to ask? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. I'm not sure that it matters, but here's one thing that I find interesting. The first time Jesus said, "This is what's going to happen to me," Peter took him aside and said, no, come here, you can't talk like that. Remember that? And tried to shut him down. The second time he explained to the 12 what was going to happen to him, they got into an argument about which of them was the greatest. The third time, now that he's explaining his death and resurrection and beating and everything, you'd think the third time's the charm. They're going to get it. No, what's their question? Well, when you are in your glory, you're going to let us, we want you to give us the seats on either side of your throne. Is that okay? Seriously? This is your question right now? This is what you're focused, this is, were you listening? When I just shared all this stuff, were you listening? Your brain was off planning the seating arrangement in my kingdom? And I'm talking about death? They said, "We want to be on the right and left." Now, what's interesting, and maybe you've heard me say this before, I don't remember, I've told this to a lot of people, but I'm pretty sure, and I think I can prove this, I'm pretty sure that James and John's mother, the wife of Zebedee, was Jesus' mother, Mary. I think they were sisters. I think they were sisters, which makes Jesus and James and John cousins. And James and John and Peter were the three who went up on and saw the transfiguration, right? So they were in this inner circle. So Peter already had this last one. "We gave up everything for you. What do we get out of this?" And now James and John are coming to Jesus behind their mother. A little bit of nepotism going on here. When you get into your kingdom, when you get into your glory, you're going to give my boys seats on either side of your throne, right? And the fact that Mark did not include their mom and Jesus talked directly to them, even in Matthew, Jesus did not respond to her. He talked directly to them, means that they put her up to it, is my assumption. "Hey, mom, why don't you go ask Jesus?" Like, how petty can this get, right, at this point? We want to be on either side of you in the kingdom. We want to have the highest place. We want to have the highest rank in your kingdom. We'll let you be king, but we want to be, like, on either side of you. And he said, "You don't even have a clue what you're asking. You have no idea what you're asking. If greatness comes out of humility, right? If greatness is a result of humility, or humility leads to greatness, humility and dependence leads to greatness, how much humility does it take to be able to have the position where Jesus, where you're sitting on either side of Jesus' throne? How humble does a person have to be before they can achieve that level of greatness? And here they come up just asking for it because they're family. And he said, you don't know what you're asking. He said, are you able to drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism that I'm going to experience? And in English, there's a three word or a two word, depending on your translation answer. In Greek, it's just one word. It's one word. It translates out, we are or we are able. But in Greek, it's just one word because of the way the language is structured. And so I read this as, yep. Yep. We got this. Jesus, don't forget, knows exactly what he's about to face, right? Are you able to do that? Are you able to go through everything that it's going to take to go through, to rise to the level where you think you can be equal or sit on my right and left? Yeah. Jesus said to them in verse 39, you will. You will drink the cup and you will be baptized with the baptism I experience. And you can sort of imagine them thinking, yes, nailed it. We got it. We're in. But to sit at my right or my left is not mine to give. I think in the context, I think it's because he does hand this out. As we look at other passages, he is the one who rewards and awards these things. So I think what he's talking about here is not mine to just give away just because people ask. It's been prepared for people as rewards. You can't just come up to me and say, hey, can I have that seat? Sure, I'll move the seating arrangement around. I don't get to do that. So they end up, in a sense, with a pretty raw deal. And it's their own making, right? They say, can we have this? Can you handle it? Yes, we can handle it. Good, you'll handle it. But I'm still not going to guarantee that you get the reward that you're looking for. So what was the cup and the baptism that they experienced? Well, we know what happened to both of these two guys in church history. James was the first of the apostles to be killed for his faith. Acts chapter 12, very early on in the church, Herod had him beheaded as a warning to everybody else. He never got to see the expansion of the church. He never got to see the Gentiles really come into the church much. He saw a little bit of it, but never saw the big expansion. He never got to be one of the writing apostles. He missed out on so much because he was executed for being one of the apostles very early on. John was the exact opposite. John lived out to a very old age, probably in his 90s, pushing 100. He got to write 5 books of the New Testament, John, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, and the Revelation. You think, well, that's not a bad deal, right? How is that bad? Here's how it's bad. He was the last of the apostles to live, which means he saw his family and his friends executed over the course of many years as different rulers came by. He saw his brother had to be executed very early on. 50 years previous to when John finally died his natural death. And when I say he died a natural death, he did. But it wasn't because the Roman emperor didn't try to kill him. There were many attempts on John's life. As the persecution of the church, as they tried to kill this guy, and God just would not let him die. And he suffered many times. And then, as he's exiled on this island, this labor island, where he probably can't even do any of the work, God shows him the revelation. Well, that would be cool to be able to see that. Really? You're going to see your nation be decimated? You're going to see Satan run loose all over the world? You're going to see the Antichrist? You're going to see all of this stuff and then have to live with that? You've seen something that is burned into your mind that you can't forget, right? You think John ever forgot? Because remember, John didn't just read like we do, right? He saw it. He had to see that devastation, see that destruction, see the blood, see the death, see the world literally being destroyed, torn apart, and then live with it for the rest of his life. This is what's coming. He'd only read about it in the prophets before. He'd never seen it. He's the only one who had to see that. Are you able to handle what I am about to handle? Oh yeah, we got this. You have no idea what you're asking. You have absolutely no idea what it takes to be mature and great. If greatness comes out of humility, the greatest are those who are humbled the most. It's like praying for patience. Have you ever prayed for patience? Don't do that. That's just stupid, right? If you pray for patience, God, I want to be more patient. What's going to happen? All sorts of stuff that you don't want to happen, you wouldn't otherwise sign up for. He's like, you wanted patience. I'm giving you every opportunity to learn how to be patient, right? They're like, we want to be great. He's like, you really want that? Because it's going to take some humility. Yeah, we got this. All right. All right. Now, is that where God wants it? Does God want us to be patient? Yes, of course. Does God want us to be humble? Yes, of course. Do we want to have to go through the things that get us there? No, we don't. And yet, isn't it interesting that those are the only things that get us there? As we walk the path, that loop of knowledge and self-control and perseverance and godliness is the process. We hear about it. We learn about it through the scriptures. We are given the opportunity to practice it, exercise it, self-control, obey it, and then there will be a test, right? We've got the lecture, we've got the homework, and now there's the test. Can we pass the test? And if we don't pass the test, then we go back and we keep trying again until we can pass that test. And then the step of godliness is where it sinks into us and actually becomes part of our character as we become more like Jesus. Because remember, that's the goal. The goal is not to become patient. The goal is not to become humble. The goal is to become like Christ in every way. Verse 41, after these two got their lesson, the other 10 heard about this. They became angry with James and John. Why did they become angry with James and John? Come on, tell me. Why were they angry? Because they didn't think of it first, right? Because how dare you go up there and ask for things for yourself? Man, I wish I would have thought about that, right? Don't you know that selfishness, lack of humility causes disunity in the group? They became angry. They became indignant. And Jesus had to teach them a lesson too. He's like, you know that the secular world does this. The secular world is a dog-eat-dog world, right? It's whatever it takes to survive. It's whatever it takes to get to the top. And it doesn't matter who you have to kick or push down in order to make your way to the top. You're going to climb that ladder, and it doesn't matter who you have to hurt. That's how the secular world works. It is not like that among you, verse 43. That's not how it works. You want to be great. It takes humility. It takes servanthood. Now, are there some good leaders in this world who are not believers and yet understand this principle of leadership? Serving to lead? Yeah, of course there are. But it's not coming out of their worldview. They're borrowing it from Jesus' worldview, aren't they? They're not borrowing that from the world. They've found that something that Jesus taught, something that God designed, actually works, and so they'll use that to their benefit. But not because they believe in him or because they believe in what he taught, but just this one principle. He said, some people in the secular world will do things our way, but we should never do things their way. Right? It doesn't matter if they borrow from our worldview, we should never borrow from their worldview. We should do things Christ's way. Selfishness always causes disunity. Our memory verse this week is verse 45. It's one that we need to sink down into our hearts and minds. He said, even the Son of Man, there's that term again, even the Son of Man, even the one who stands in the throne room of God and is given the kingdom and will rule forever, even he did not come to be served. Wait a minute, how can the King of all things, the King of glory, the King of the universe, not be served? Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Yeah, but I'm on a special mission here right now. And on this mission here right now that I've been trying to tell you about, I'm not here to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many, or literally a ransom in place of many. That concept of ransom is a payment to free or a payment to release somebody else, right? You know, ransom notes and stuff that we see. It's the same concept all over the Old Testament, and Jesus used it here as well. His death and resurrection was the payment necessary to free us, to free people. We were slaves to sin. We were slaves to self. We were slaves to everything negative, our sin nature. And Jesus said, there is a price due, and I will pay it with my life. I am the ransom in place of. And that in most of our translation, it'll probably say ransom for many, but it is a substitutionary word in place of many, which was very poignant at that time as they're headed toward Jerusalem for Passover, when the lamb would be sacrificed in place of the person offering it. Paul later will call Jesus our Passover lamb, our Paschal lamb, the one who was killed, slaughtered in our place. Now, there's one more story, and it's about a blind man. And there's a lot of parallels here. Jericho is about 15 miles away from Jerusalem, and this is the last leg. And as they're headed from Jericho to Jerusalem, they come across a blind man sitting on the road. We don't get to find out the blind man's name. None of the other, not Matthew nor Luke, tell us what his name is, just refer to him as the blind man. Mark tells us in verse 46, Bartimaeus, the son of Timaeus, was a blind beggar, was sitting by the road. You say, well, isn't that his name, Bartimaeus? No, it's not. Does anybody see the connection between Bartimaeus and Timaeus? See that in there? It's the same thing, just with a bar in front of it, right? In Hebrew, if you wanted to say son of, you would say Ben and then the father's name. In Aramaic, it would be Bar and then the father's name. Remember the old Charlton Heston movie out of the book Ben-Hur? Remember, the guy's name was actually Judah Ben-Hur. His first name was not Ben. Okay, it's not like Ben-Hur. His first name was Judah. Judah Ben-Hur. Hur was his dad. Judah, son of Hur. Okay, if I had named my children that way, the daughters would be Bat or Bath, and so my children, we have great Hebrew names, so it just works wonderfully. So I would have my sons would all be Ben or Bar Daniel, and my daughter would be Bath or Bat Daniel. We have surnames now, we have last names, so we don't do that as much anymore. But that's how they named their people. So. Apparently, Timaeus was somebody that people knew, because all we'd find out about this guy is that he was Bartimaeus, who's just the son of Timaeus. And so Mark wrote it twice, once in Aramaic and once in Greek, because his readers didn't know Aramaic, right? Because he's writing to people in Rome. And so he said, there was a guy sitting on the side of the road, Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. That's all we know. So we don't get to call him Bart for short. Okay, because that's not his name, right? So we don't know what his first name was. He's just Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus. And he's sitting on the road. So apparently Timaeus was somebody. And he hears that Jesus is coming by, and he's heard about Jesus before. And he says, oh, son of David, Jesus, have mercy on me. What son of David? King, Messiah, the Son of David, the Son of Man, the King, he says, I know there's something special about this guy. He's going to be the King. He's going to be the Messiah. Have mercy on me. And the people around are just like, shut up, stop, stop. Maybe we're trying to listen to him. He's talking with the 12. We're trying to overhear it. Something, you know, we're eavesdropping, something. And you're annoying us. You're interrupting us. We're on our way to Jerusalem. We're special. We're whatever. Stop. We gave you the couple of coins. Stop already. Did he stop? No. He got stronger. He's like, more, Son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus stopped. And he said, call him. So they called him. And the same people, I think, who had just said, shut up, are now like, take courage, he wants to see you. It's amazing how fast we can swing, right? And they brought him to Jesus, and Jesus asked, does this question sound at all familiar? What should I do for you? What do you want me to do for you? Does that sound familiar? James and John had just said, we want you to give us a blank check so that you do anything that we ask. He's like, what do you want me to do for you? This guy comes up and Jesus says, what do you want me to do for you? James and John said, make us the greatest in your kingdom. Bartimaeus says, just let me see again, please. Isn't that amazing? In the NET, it's translated rabbi. Does anybody have a different translation there in verse 51, other than rabbi, if you have a different translation? Looking, verse 51. Does everybody says rabbi? Rabboni? 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 Okay, good. Does anybody else have a different one? Rabbi? Okay, what translation do you have? You have no idea, right? Yeah. That's okay. New King James. Okay, all right. So New King James wins the prize today because the difference between rabbi and if we were to put an O-N in between the B and the I there, rabboni, okay, it changes from just rabbi or master, it's an Aramaic term, to my master. It's very personal, very personal. The E at the end becomes my. And so here we have a man, and the reason I point that out is not because of the language thing, but listen to the attitude between James and John and Bartimaeus. James and John, we want you to do anything that we want for us. What do you want me to do? Make us the greatest in your kingdom. Son of David, have mercy on me. What would you like me to do? My master, please let me see again. He'd lost his sight somehow. Apparently that's common in the Middle East, based on what I was reading. He had lost his sight somehow. Please let me see again, my master. James and John said, teacher, very formal, do this for us. He said, my master, have mercy on me. See the difference? See the parallels here? And Jesus said, go, your faith has healed you. And immediately he regained his sight and followed him on the road as he walked to Jerusalem. So we've got James and John following him after being scolded, the other 10 following after being scolded, a whole bunch of people who didn't even know who Jesus was, couldn't have picked him out of the crowd, and Bartimaeus, who actually was the only one who saw what was really going on. Isn't that amazing? Humility is what Jesus is looking for, not greatness. He can work with people who are humble. But we don't want to get to the point where he has to humble us because we want to be great, right? James and John had to be humbled. Bartimaeus came to him humble already. It's a big difference. And I love this parallel that Mark puts these two stories together to show us exactly what it is that Jesus is looking for. So as we wrap up this morning, this section, There are two responses to Jesus, I think. And especially when he does things for us. When he works in us, when he does things for us, when he answers a prayer, when he whatever. And maybe even the longer we spend time with him. There are two big responses. We can be like James and John and the disciples, and we can get lazy, and we can get entitled, and we can get less reliant on him and more reliant on ourselves. Or we can be like Bartimaeus, where we can become more grateful, where we can become humble, where we can realize how reliant we really are on him. And we will always choose one of those two responses, won't we? Those are, I think, probably the only two. I don't know if there is a middle ground in this one. We'll begin to rely on ourselves and how much we deserve him to work for us. Or we will realize just how little we deserve, and we become grateful that he wants to work in and through and for us. What is our response as we go through life? What is our response as we pray? What is our response when he does work in us? That's our challenge. At least that's what I saw in the passage this morning. Maybe you saw something else on the back of your connection card. I'd love for you to tell me what you saw, what principle you learned. I want everybody to fill out your connection card, please. And memorize verse 45, even the Son of Man. How dare we think that we can get through this life, especially those of us who call ourselves Christians. How dare we think that we can get through this life not having to serve other people, thinking that we deserve something when even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and in fact, to give up his life as payment in place of us. It's a good reminder this week. I hope it is for me. And I hope it is for you too. If you're interested in any of those camps and stuff that I was talking about, put that on your connection card. Put the principle that you learned today for Mark chapter 10 on your connection card. I'd love to hear it. Let's pray together, and then we'll be done.